This is the first day of the five-week introductory course in mindfulness meditation. And my name is Gil Fronsdal, and I'm the teacher for our little Palo Alto sitting group. Not so little anymore. We meet several days a week. And Thursday evenings is the day where the focus of the evening is very practical on the practice of meditation. And then three times a year, I do this introductory course on this Thursday evening from 7 to 8:30. And to just say a few introductory things, well, maybe some people are still coming in. I've been a practitioner of a Buddhist meditation, for over 25 years, and have trained extensively in the Zen tradition. And then I also went to Southeast Asia, to Thailand and Burma, where I was introduced to the practice of Vipassana, more popular in English, it's called mindfulness meditation or insight meditation, and became very enamored with the practice of mindfulness. And found it to be very, very powerful. And I came back to this country and then continued with doing my training in this particular form of meditation. And then in 1989, I started a four-year training program with Jack Kornfield to be a Vipassana or mindfulness teacher. And then in 1990 is when I also started teaching here in Palo Alto. And so it's almost 10 years now that I've been teaching here in this community. I came to this area because I was going to be a student at Stanford, and of all things to study, quite originally for me, I was going to do Buddhist studies. So I have a PhD in Buddhist studies, which doesn't mean much except that I have a big interest in Buddhism. So I'm curious to ask some of you now, or ask you. This is an introductory course in mindfulness meditation, mindfulness practice. How many of you have had some instructions in any kind of meditation practice before this? Sounds like most of you. So I can just not say anything tonight. I sit quietly. And how many of you have had, those of you answered, how many of you had not had instructions, have had instructions from other practice besides mindfulness and not in mindfulness meditation? So it's a small group that have had no instructions in this. So the class is oriented mostly to the people who've had no instructions, so you should feel very welcome here, and I'll hopefully address your concerns as we go along here. The class is structured over 5 weeks to be sequential, to build on the weeks. There's no inherent reason in the teaching of the practice of mindfulness to do it that way. It just, you can get the whole instructions very quickly. But it tends to be a lot more beneficial for people to kind of get pieces of it one at a time, and then spend a week kind of exploring that particular foundation of the mindfulness practice, and then to go on to the next one after that. And there's a sequence that kind of makes sense. The first week we'll talk about using the breath for the focus of the meditation. The breath being one of the great, almost universal focuses of meditation, of calming and of insight. And then on that foundation of the settledness that can come with breath meditation, then the second week we'll talk about how to incorporate our embodied experience of life, our physical experience, our body, as part of the meditation practice. And which is very nice. There are some spiritual practices which exclude the body, and you don't, it's all in the head or in the imagination. And mindfulness is very much an embodied practice, that we really use our body. And then the third week, we talk about mindfulness of emotions and how to incorporate and include emotions as part of the spiritual practice. The fourth week is how to include thoughts as part of what we pay attention to in mindfulness practice. And then the fifth week is more about how to bring our attention, bring our mindfulness into our everyday life, how to integrate it into the rest of our life outside of meditation. And the better you understand 1 week, the easier it is to understand the next week. They kind of build on each other, support each other. These talks are being taped. Allison, who's sitting here, makes them available. If some people who miss a class and know they're going to miss a class like to get a copy of that week's class so that they can keep up with how it goes here. The class is offered on a donation basis for several reasons. One of them is that it's a part of the Buddhist tradition to offer Buddhist teachings freely, to offer them kind of freely in a kind of donation basis. And it's a very wise tradition, and one that's a little bit confusing for people in the West who sometimes have a very different sense of economics and what money means and how it's exchanged. There's something very special and very valuable in making it all available freely to everyone, not least of which is that for those people who don't have much means, they can. Money is not a hindrance for them coming to get these kinds of teachings and opportunities to practice. But what we do is to put two baskets out in the hallway if you want to make a donation. And there's two because one of them, I think it says Sangha Dana. Dana is the Buddhist, what?
Expense.
Sangha expense?
It's just the expense Dana.
Oh, expense Dana. Oh, it's a new name. So that makes sense in English. So that's good. And so the idea is we have some expenses for renting this room and for publishing our newsletter and paying for our telephone that we have. Some of you might have called and got information from our voice line. So the only way we pay for that is by those people who make contributions to help make it happen. And then there's another basket for the teacher donation. And I'm the teacher here this time, today. So it'll be a donation to me. And this is what I do. I devoted my life to being a Buddhist teacher, a Buddhist minister, a Buddhist meditation teacher. And oddly enough, my income comes from what people donate. A very, very unusual way of living. But it allows me to do this kind of, it allows me to come here and teach just to get supported. So it's completely voluntary on your part whether you like to contribute. For the expense dana, the suggestion is that everyone does, if you did $2 each, that would cover our expenses quite nicely. And for the introductory, usually we don't make a recommendation for how much you make for teacher dana. But for the introductory course, I do make a recommendation, that is, or suggestion, and that is $10 per class. For the 5 weeks, $50. But that's really for you to decide. You know, whatever you want. Some people will pay nothing, and some people will pay maybe a lot. Who knows? Maybe it'll balance out at $10, the average. So so before I actually start with the teachings and the instructions, does anyone have any questions for anything logistically or anything that seems that you would like to ask here as we start? Makes sense to ask? Yes.
I couldn't hear the word that you called this kind of meditation.
So the. The Buddhist word is vipassana, which is spelled V-I-P-A-S-S-A-N-A. And that's translated into English by two English words, usually. One is insight, which is probably closer to a literal translation. And then the other is mindfulness. And mindfulness has now gotten very popular in the West and entered into the Western culture in secular ways through stress reduction programs and things. But a little bit more literally would be translated as insight. Yes?
Oh, it's a little bit difficult to hear back here.
Uh-huh. Do other people in the back have trouble hearing? Move up to the front then. Why don't you come sit right here? Yeah? I don't bite. And so I'll try to speak up, but... other concerns before we start here? Okay, so welcome again to the class. So, let me start this way. The practice of mindfulness, of vipassana, comes from the Buddhist tradition. As it's been taught in America, there's often been an emphasis to try to offer it without a lot of the Buddhist trappings, without a lot of the Buddhist kind of context, some of the Buddhist teachings, some of the Buddhist ritual and forms that it existed in Asia. Partly because it's understood to be a very, very powerful practice that's applicable both in our daily lives in very simple ways, but also it's in the depth of our spiritual lives. It's the practice of vipassana that Buddhists say, in the context of Buddhism, is the most transformative spiritual practice that Buddhism has to offer. And the ultimate spiritual depth and possibility of freedom that Buddhism offers is said in Buddhism only to be done through this particular practice I'm going to be teaching you. And there are people who teach it without that emphasis, but just simply it's a better way of coping in daily life. It's a better way of coping with physical pain or with difficult emotions, or better way of coping at work. It just brings some mindfulness to the job. So it's a very powerful practice, and we'd like to just offer it freely to people without them being burdened, if it's a burden, by the Buddhist context. I'll be referring to Buddhism. I'm a Buddhist, and those of you who don't feel comfortable with that kind of language, I think it's easy enough just to tune it out. It's not needed. So you can deal with that as you wish. But if we start right away with the Buddhist part of it, what the Buddha had to teach can be summarized very briefly in a very simple line. So this is one of the ways of summarizing it. And you might find this a little bit surprising. One of the great world religions can be summarized with this statement: nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. What do you think of that? This great world religion is the core of it. Everything in Buddhism arises out of this one teaching, that nothing at all is worth clinging to. If I hold this bell in my hand, if I just hold it lightly like this, it makes a nice sound. If I cling to it, it can't do its job. The presence of clinging in our lives is really pervasive. And as a person starts paying attention to their life more, it's a surprise to realize how much more pervasive it is in our lives than we realized. We cling to all kinds of things. We cling to comfort, we cling to security, we cling to relationships, we cling to jobs, we cling to material goods, we cling to, whatever the world has, we can cling, whatever it is in the world, human beings are capable of clinging to it. Have you noticed that? And one of the truths is that there's a difference between holding something and clinging to it. The clinging, if you cling to something really tightly, it hurts. Pretty soon your hands get tired and stressed and numb and sweaty. And if you hold it, you can do it a lot longer. Clinging hurts. What the Buddha said is that most of what he called suffering in our lives arises from our clinging. The way in which we cling to things. We might have a lot of problems in life. We might have a lot of pain in our life and discomfort. But we tend to add to that some form of clinging. And clinging has two forms. It's either actually holding things really tightly or trying to push it away tightly. And the teaching of Buddhism is all about learning how to stop that clinging. It's not about learning how to stop holding. In order to live a responsible life, you have to hold things. But can we hold things without the clinging? That's really the goal. And 90% of the stress that people experience in our stressful society is usually attributed to the environment. It's my job, it's the commute, it's the all the noise, it's the this or that. But if you really pay attention to what's going on inside of you, it isn't that the noise or the commute or the whatever or your boss is causing you stress. It's the condition for it, but the real stress arises when we react and relate to that condition by some form of clinging. We tighten up, we contract, we resist, we lean forward with great ambition. I have to have that. We are filled with a certain kind of drivenness. Drivenness, which is pervasive in our culture, to be driven by compulsion, driven by ambition, driven by fear, is another way of talking about clinging. It's a form of clinging. And what the Buddha was teaching was how to live a life that's not driven by compulsion, not driven by clinging, not driven by fear. To be neurotically defensive is a form of clinging. To be neurotically afraid is a form of clinging. So in the Buddhist tradition, this word clinging is really central. Now what's remarkable about this little statement, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to, is that this is a great world religion, and this is the central tenet. But there's nothing metaphysical about it. There's nothing supernatural about it. It's just like, I think all of you have had an experience of clinging, haven't you? You know, if you haven't, you can go home now. Or come and take my place. And I'll listen to you. And it's that experience of suffering or stress or strain that arises from our clinging, which mindfulness meditation is really trying to address. At the simple daily kind of mundane levels, it's helping us not to add that clinging or that stress in our daily kind of situations, jobs, relationships, the commute, or whatever it might be. As the meditation gets deeper, as there's great stability in the mind and we can really learn to see clearly, we see that some of the fundamental ways in which we see ourselves, we hold ourselves, fundamental ways in which we have our persona is created, also is born out of clinging. But it's very subtle. It's not seen in normal kind of street consciousness most people are walking around with. But when there's a very clear, powerful ability to see, we see that some of the very ideas we have about who we are is imbued with also clinging. And as we can get deep down into the very clinging to notions of self and uproot the clinging to notions of self, that the actual so-called Buddhist spiritual work really begins and ends. It's not just simply a matter of coping and getting more comfortable with work and relationships and all that, but really getting down to the roots of how we cling to some notion of self. So, mindfulness meditation is a very simple practice in and of itself. It's using our ability to notice things, using our ability to pay attention, and developing that ability. All of us, all of you hopefully are listening to what I'm saying now. And that ability, or maybe you're thinking you're lost in your thoughts, but in either case, you're paying attention to something. That ability to pay attention to something is, you all have. We're taking that ability and developing it and strengthening it. So it's not a strange thing. It's not like this mystical, bizarre thing that we've kind of imported from the mysterious Asia or whatever. It's something that we're just taking something you already have and strengthening it, maybe like a muscle. And it's a very, very simple thing to pay attention. There's a wonderful story that I like to tell of Hakuin, a famous Zen master, who one of the responsibilities of Zen masters in ancient Japan was to do calligraphy and write poetry. So people would come to them and ask them to do some calligraphy. So some very wealthy bureaucrat or wealthy businessman with a certain amount of arrogance and pomp came to him and presented him with fancy paper and fancy ink and said, "Please write the essence of Buddhism on this scroll for me so I can hang it in my my home. And so the Zen master said, oh yeah. And he wrote down, attention. And he handed it to the guy. And he said, no, you misunderstood. What I want is the essence of Buddhism, the central kernel of what the true teachings of Buddhism, the Buddha really was. And the Zen master said, oh, I see, okay. And he took a second piece of paper and he wrote, attention, attention. And the guy said, no, you don't understand. I want something really profound. Something really, I can go home and have deep philosophical conversations with my friends, and you know, what's the real profundity of Buddhism? It's a world religion after all. Oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't understand. Okay. Then he wrote a third time, attention, attention, attention. That's, you know, another way of saying the center of Buddhism is to learn to pay attention. One of the qualities of paying attention, which goes overlooked by many of us, is that the act of attending to something, the act of noticing that something is present, in and of itself does not judge what you're knowing. The act of paying attention in and of itself does not resist the object of attention. The act of paying attention itself does not desire to have what you're paying attention to. You might do those things in addition, but your ability to just know something in its simplicity doesn't do those things. It's in some ways very forgiving, very compassionate, very accepting. It's like a mirror. The mirror doesn't care what appears in front of it, does it? There it is. Some mornings you wake up and you're kind of, you know, groggy and ugly, and the mirror doesn't care. And some days you wake up and you're refreshed and you look beautiful and radiant, and the mirror doesn't care. The mirror just reflects what's there. Attention, our ability to know what's happening in the moment, is like that. It doesn't judge, it doesn't criticize, it just sees things that they are. This is to notice this quality of your attention can provide a transformative effect in our lives, because most of us spend a lot of time judging and criticizing, evaluating, measuring, comparing, doing all the extra stuff. What we're doing, as we're strengthening our ability to bring this very simple attention, we're bringing this radiant quality of mind up to the forefront and letting that predominate, let that be the center of our gravity, center of our life, where our life comes from, as opposed to letting the center of our life come from our criticisms, our judgments, the shoulds and shouldn'ts, the measures, the comparative thinking we have about what's going on. And our clinging often arises, deep clinging often arises out of all these funny ways in which we judge and evaluate and want and don't want what we know. The training of mindfulness, and it takes a while to understand that this is even worth doing, but training of mindfulness is to kind of pull ourselves a little bit out of that world where we tend to live, into the world of just seeing with great clarity what's happening right now, what's happening right now. One of the things, so clear seeing is in some sense the goal. One of the things that will happen as you start doing this is you start noticing how much of the time you spend being distracted. How difficult it is to stay present to see clearly what's going on in the present moment. We tend to spend a lot of time reviewing the past, improving on the past. Someone once said, forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. So we spend a lot of time in the past, and we spend a lot of time in the future, planning. And planning, and my impression is planning is epidemic here. You know, I think it's the kind of, almost kind of, we're so driven in this Silicon Valley, and there's not enough time, and for many people, and you know, and there's a certain level of anxiety and accomplishment and getting things, and so there's a lot of planning going on. So we'll talk about that a little bit. So we get lost in the future, or we get lost in fantasy, and we start bringing our attention to the, or we wake up our attention. We start noticing what's happening in the present moment, and what we notice soon enough is, I just lost it. I just spent the last 5 seconds, 5 minutes, somewhere else in my mind. Someone once said, we are distracted from our distractions by our distractions. It's that bad. So in developing a strength of mindfulness, it's developing two things. A strength in the mindfulness itself, so that a mindfulness, our ability to see and know, becomes stronger than the power of our distractions. And the other thing we're developing is a strength. The other thing we're doing is becoming familiar enough with the things that distract us, the forces of distractions, that they begin becoming weaker. They begin to stop having this great hold on us. And if the forces that distract us stop having a hold on us, or we stop gripping them or clinging to them, you'll find yourself living at a lot more peaceful life. A peaceful heart, a peaceful mind, is a mind, the heart, which doesn't cling. And a mind that doesn't cling has no stress. And a mind that has no stress and doesn't cling is a mind or heart which is available for a lot of the goodness of life, a lot of the goodness of our hearts. When I was teaching recently, I was teaching a children's program, and I was teaching them about clinging. And I told them about, you know, if you make a really hard fist, I said, if you really hold that for a long time, is that going to hurt? And he said, well, that's really going to hurt. I'm going to get tired. And the other thing the kids noticed is that in order to have a really hard, tight fist, really hard, so it hurts, you have to keep doing it. Every few seconds, you have to remember to do it some more, because the natural tendency of the hand is to release, to relax. And I said, you know, what can you do with a closed fist? And I said, well, you can punch someone out, or you can pound on the table or something. You've done so much you can do of interest. And then I said, how does it feel to have your hand open? And they said, oh, it's a lot better, it's more relaxed. And then I said, you know, what can you do with an open hand? And you can do interesting things with an open hand. You can shake hands with someone. You can pat them on the shoulder when they're feeling kind of down. You can make a gesture of friendship, of open-handedness, of peacefulness. You can feel the breeze in your hand. So the mind that doesn't cling, the heart that doesn't cling, is a heart that's available in this open-hearted, open-handed way for love, for compassion, for peace, for relatedness to other people. So, as we do this 5-week course, what you'll notice, or maybe what will confuse you unless I explain it to you now, is that I'm not going to always differentiate very clearly between giving you instructions for meditation practice, formal sitting and meditation, versus giving you instructions for mindfulness, paying attention in your daily life. Because in my mind, there's no real difference. It's an artificial difference. And the power of this practice exists in it being integrated in all our life, not just in meditation. So when you listen to me, you just have to go along with me and realize I'll be kind of sliding back and forth, and hopefully you don't get confused now that you've been warned. Meditation practice then, formal meditation practice, which is a great place to begin, is usually done in the sitting posture. There are other postures you can do formal meditation in. You can do it laying down if you have back problems. You can do it standing, and you can do it walking. But most people find it most pragmatic to begin with sitting meditation. And for sitting meditation, it's best to begin getting a comfortable posture that allows you to keep your back upright and alert for the length of time that meditation is going to last. So I would like to go through a few points about sitting posture. First, I'll talk mostly about sitting on the floor, which is the ancient tradition of how to meditate. And then I'll talk about how to sit in a chair, which is the modern tradition, especially today, a lot of you in chairs. And it's fine to sit in chairs. There are some pragmatic advantages sitting on the floor. To have your center of gravity lower, there's a way in which that almost allows the body to relax more easily in an appropriate way. And it kind of feel more stable. And having that stability of a tripod on the floor is really helpful for the kind of the feeling, the experience of trust, trusting our body, trusting gravity that comes with meditation. So there are some advantages to sitting cross-legged, but you don't have to do it. In sitting cross-legged on the floor, I recommend that people sit with both feet on the ground, one in front of the other. So the feet are actually not crossed at all, but like this, right? So you can, I hope you can see or see this way. So they're not crossed, but they're one in front of the other. And that tends to be the easiest for people, but to actually cross them, to bring one foot up on your thigh in half lotus, or both feet up in full lotus, with actually a cross, like a pretzel, most people can't do. So it's a lot easier to do just the, one foot flat in front of the other. And then sitting on the floor, it's very helpful to sit raised, to sit on some kind of cushion or pillow. And classically, or not classically, but coming from the Japanese tradition, we have these round cushions that we sit on. And there are other options for cushions. There's half moons, like Allison has a half moon there. And some people like to sit on those. And the idea is to sit in such a way that you're elevated, your pelvis gets tipped forward slightly, so it's easier to get your knees down on the ground. And if you have both knees on the ground, then you have this tripod with your knees and your butt, and tripods are stable. Different people have different openness or flexibility in their hips, so you might have to experiment with different heights. Some people sit really high on two cushions, some people sit really low, to experiment in how to sit. If you can't get your knees down, sometimes you can put a pillow under one of the knees and prop it up, and that can be helpful. Also, there's this bench you can sit on, and some people like sitting on benches. And then you're not sitting cross-legged, but you're sitting kind of on top of your knees this way. And that's a nice way of sitting. It's not as symmetrical or as balanced as cross-legged, but it's pretty good. And some people like to go back and forth if they're not used to this. If you have a round cushion like this, maybe a little bit thicker than the one I have, you can do the same thing by putting it upright between your ankles and sitting on it like this. You can buy these kinds of cushions at, I think, East West Books, and you can also buy them from Allison, who sells them. I think Allison sells them cheaper, so it's a little better deal here. But so to sit cross-legged this way, or, and the idea is to sit in such a way that your back can be alert and upright. And having a straight spine, as probably any of you know, is a challenge for those people who spend most of the day in the office, sitting in chairs and in front of a computer. And so we often develop bad habits. So it can take a while to kind of even discover what that's like, to sit upright in an aligned way. In sitting in a chair, the usual way is not to cross your legs in the chair, but have the legs parallel to each other and have them going straight out. And best if the knees were maybe slightly lower than the hips. Certainly knees shouldn't be higher than the hips. But you want ideally to have a right angle with your knees. So it really provides some sense of stability. When you're sitting in a chair or sitting on the floor, it's pragmatically, not spiritually, but maybe, but it's pragmatically most useful not to use a backrest. If you need to use a backrest because of back issues, that's fine to use a backrest. But there's a kind of a way in which our inner life, our psychic life, psychological life, is closely tied to our physical life. These two aren't separate from each other. And in that Buddhism, another way of maybe worth talking about non-clinging is to talk about becoming self-reliant. And becoming self-reliant is easier to discover if you're not relying on a backrest for your posture. The inner self-reliance is easier to discover if you have physical self-reliance. So if you're sitting in a chair, if your back allows for it, is actually to sit away from the backrest, kind of scoot out a little bit, so you're sitting up straight and not resting in the chair. There's a very different kind of relaxation that can happen in the body when you relax down straight as opposed to backward into a backrest. If you have to use a backrest, if you can just use a backrest in the lower part of your back, that's then the next ideal. Maybe get a towel or a pillow and wrap it up really tight and force it into your lower back and really prop you up properly. And the idea is to sit in such a way that you're either in a chair or on the floor where your back is straight, and keep your hands in any kind of posture where the hands are doing the same thing. They're symmetrical. Hands on your knees, hands on your... Classically in Buddhism, the hands are together, but doesn't together or like this. If you're sitting on the floor, sometimes the distance between your ankles and your shoulders pulls the shoulders forward and creates strain. So if you put some kind of pillow on top of your ankles, your hands are held higher. It can be helpful. And then we sit with our eyes closed and with the mouth closed and the tongue resting up against the roof of the mouth. And it's also helpful, it's usually said, if you tuck your chin down a little bit when you meditate. Because when you think a lot, the chin tends to go out and up. And it's said this controls the wandering mind, though you probably won't believe it. But a different way of saying the same thing is you take the space between the last vertebrae and the skull and open that space up a little bit. And that tends to kind of do the same thing, but you actually feel more kind of openness by doing that. And I think that's also helpful. So those are the simple basics on posture. And if later, after the class, or some other time you want to ask about particular issues around posture, please ask. I'm one of the Vipassana teachers who specialize a little bit on the issues of posture and meditation. So meditation then starts with taking an alert, comfortable, upright posture. And then we usually begin by focusing on the breathing. It's interesting to me that maybe it's, I don't know if I should say this, but the words in English, spiritual inspiration, both those words contain the word breath in it. Spirit, like respiration, spiritus in Latin, also had the meaning of breath. And so when we say spiritual inspiration, we're referring to the breath. We can, at least in the etymology of the word. A lot of different cultures in the world have focused on the breath as being something really key to our human existence, to our human life, our spiritual life. And Buddhism uses the breath as a real foundation. For nothing else, we train ourselves to be in the present on our breathing as a way of beginning to overcome the tendency of the mind to be a crazy monkey that just kind of grabs after, you know, crazy monkeys, they grab for one branch and they grab for the next one and then the next one, and they just kind of swing through the jungle grabbing one branch or the other, never satisfied with any one branch. So the mind is that way, just grabs for one thing to cling to, then another thing to cling to, and one distraction, one preoccupation. And there's a tremendous power in the mind being caught up in its concerns. And by focusing on something very simple, the breathing, we begin to slowly retrain the mind and release the grip that we have on all these preoccupations so the mind can start becoming peaceful. So it's very wonderful, the breath, because it's so simple. The breath is usually not tied up with all the complicated dramas of our life. And many of us tend to be so preoccupied with the dramas of my history or what's going to happen tomorrow or whatever, and we're looking for the solution in the drama. It's a very powerful, transformative event to step out of your drama and just very simply focus on something so simple as the breathing, to begin to retrain the mind so the mind can be luminous and at peace as opposed to clinging and preoccupied with things. And once the mind is at peace and calm, it can see your situation with so much more clarity than if you're completely consumed and preoccupied with the drama of it all. So we start with the breathing. We start with the breathing as a place we begin training ourselves to stay in the present moment. Start training ourselves to let go of all the concerns that we normally get caught up in. And start training ourselves to start becoming calm and a little bit more peaceful as we sit here. So take the best meditation posture you can as you're sitting here. So take a comfortable but alert posture. Maybe allowing your spine to be a little bit more alert than you normally would. Gently close your eyes. And then in the beginning of a period of meditation, it's helpful to take a few deep breaths. Breathe deeply into your body, feeling connection to your body as you breathe in. And then as you breathe out, relax your body. Relax around your alert spine. Breathing deeply to kind of clear out, just to some degree, the concerns and momentum of your day. And remind yourself that now for the next short while, you're going to be sitting here paying attention to your breathing. And then having done that, let your breathing return to normal. Let the breath breathe itself whatever way it wants. And there's no right or wrong way of breathing for this practice. Don't be concerned about how you're breathing. Just let yourself breathe whatever way it is. And then also at the beginning of a period of meditation, it can be useful to kind of scan through your body and relax some of the muscles, large muscles that might be easy to relax. You might start with your forehead and just let it kind of soften a little bit. Sometimes the jaws can be softened and relaxed. Maybe it's possible to relax your shoulders, at least have them soften a little bit. And it can be helpful to let your stomach be relaxed. Let your stomach hang forward in an unbecoming way. If you have a belt that's tight, to relax it. And then take a few moments to feel your body as you're sitting here. Just to feel and sense what it's like to be a human being sitting here in a body without any idea of right and wrong. Just feel how it is from the inside. And then within your body, as part of your body, become aware of your breathing. Become aware of how your body experiences the breathing. Maybe you experience the rising and falling of the chest, the expansion and contraction of the rib cages. Maybe you feel the rising and falling of the abdomen as you breathe. Perhaps the warmer air breathing out. Start paying attention to the very simple experience of breathing in and breathing out, what it feels like in the body to do that. Feeling the breathing wherever it's most pronounced, whether it's the stomach or the chest or the nostrils. Just resting your attention in that part of your body and feeling the alternate rhythms of breathing in and breathing out. Letting yourself relax into each breath. Inevitably, you'll notice the mind wanders off in some kind of thinking. In the practice of meditation, you're asked simply to notice that that's happened, and then very gently begin again, feeling your breathing in the body. It doesn't matter if 10,000 times your mind wanders off in thought. It just matters that when you notice, you gently begin again feeling your breathing, trying to rest in the continuity of breathing in and breathing out, relaxing your thoughts and concerns. As simply as you can, just feeling the breathing, trying to hang in there with it. Kind of hanging in with the breathing, not letting the mind wander off in other concerns, but doing it gently. Remembering that there's nothing in the mindfulness itself that requires us to judge or evaluate how it's going. Simply let things be as they are, letting go of your thoughts and concerns, and just very simply hang in there with your breathing. Which do you feel most clearly, the in-breath or the out-breath? Can you feel how the body experiences the in-breath and the out-breath differently? This spirit of mindfulness meditation is a spirit of acceptance. No need to be critical or to struggle if the mind wanders away. Accept it all. But when you notice it, the best of your ability, let go and come back to your breathing. Just hang in there with the simplicity of breathing in and breathing out, letting the mind become quieter as you do it. So we'll sit here for one more minute. In this last minute, see if you can give yourself over to breathing, just being with your breath completely, as if it's the most interesting thing in the universe. So the word vipassana the pasana part of the word means to see, and V means like something special, intensifier. So it means something like special seeing, clear seeing. And that's really what the practice is about, is learning how to see clearly what's happening. More so than becoming calmer or more centered or more peaceful or more concentrated and all these things. Learning to see what's up, what's actually happening here. One of the first things that new meditators will often discover when they start meditating is that their mind is out of control. And one of the conclusions, there's no need to make any conclusions, but one of the conclusions that they often come to is it's hopeless. But I say, congratulations. You've now attained the first stage of meditation. You now know something you didn't know before. You now see something you didn't know you see before. Now you see very clearly that your mind is out of control. It's much better to see that than it is not to see it and continue living that way. Now, it can be a little bit more unpleasant to know that it's happening than to continue to live asleep to it happening. But the beginning of the process of waking up requires some degree us to face honestly what's actually going on in our hearts and in our minds. If the mind is really wild, the first thing is to honestly see that and really see it and not run away from it, not to come to some conclusion and give up. It's really, most people when they start meditating, that's what they experience sooner or later, if not right away. So just congratulate yourself for the first stage. And then to have a lot of patience. And just the practice is to see what's happening, not getting someplace special like getting calm or getting concentrated. Those things might happen as byproducts, but the main function of staying with the breathing is to help us see more clearly. Part of this process is to help bring, and part, some people will define meditation as a practice of unifying the body and the mind. What I call this is the process of bringing the mind and the body to the same place at the same time. Now, most of you think that's always the case, but your body is sitting here in this room right now. Your mind during the meditation might have been at work earlier today. It might have been at work tomorrow. It might be fantasizing about the television program you're missing by being here. You know, what's going on? Your mind can be many different places. What we're trying to do is to bring our mind and the body together, so that the mind and the body are together in the same place at the same time. So can our minds, our attention, be here in this body, sitting in this place, in this time, right now? That's a training. It's a training to do that over and over again. It requires a lot of patience, because I forget the calculation now, but I think by the time someone has reached the age of 30, they've lived something like 9 million minutes. And how many of those 9 million minutes, by the time you were 30, were you really present? So your mind and the body were in the same place. They probably happened accidentally a few times. But we have a lot of momentum of letting our mind just kind of do whatever it wants and kind of chasing after this preoccupation and that fear and reacting to that. And we have to be very patient. The process of meditation is incredibly efficient if you measure it against 9 million minutes so far. You don't have to do many minutes to kind of adjust for that. But if you're in the middle of your meditation, the fact that you've been sitting now for a month and your mind is still a little bit distracted, it might seem like, well, this is not working. But you have to realize you're dealing with all this momentum. And you have to be very patient as the mind begins to retrain itself and it begins to settle down and becomes easier and easier to kind of be in the present moment. But that's the task, is to be in the present moment with the mind and the body in the same place at the same time. So Any comments or about or questions about your experience in 20 minutes we meditated now, or anything I've said so far? What was it like to sit for 20 minutes on following the breath? Easy, difficult, nice?
Oh.
Yes?
When I was paying attention to my breath, it became very hard to breathe. You know, it's difficult, but when I'm not paying attention to it, I do fine.
Uh-huh.
So what I wanted to do was to get away from paying attention to it, so I would be struggling.
Uh-huh. It's a somewhat common event that sooner or later people will find themselves controlling the breathing, holding it or forcing it in this particular pattern. And the beauty of this particular meditation practice is that it doesn't matter. Our mind will have all these judgments. That's wrong, it's uncomfortable, I shouldn't be doing it. After all, I've been in California for many years, I'm supposed to have a deep, long breath. And, it's not happening, and spiritually I must be off. But the beauty about this practice, the practice itself doesn't care if you're controlling it or not, the breath or not. What we're asked to do in this practice is simply notice carefully how our breath is. And if you're controlling your breath, just peacefully, just continue to notice, become a world-class expert. What's that like? You know, and one of the things you'll notice is uncomfortable, but that's okay. Just really notice what it's like. It's that simple. And sooner or later, it'll change. And the easier you are about it being there, the quicker you'll relax about it also. But the practice of mindfulness is clear seeing of what's actually up. It's not about trying to adjust what's up so much.
So we're
experts at wanting to adjust. We don't accept things, so let's fix things and let's get in there and make it better. But the mindfulness works most effectively, most powerfully and transformationally. We will learn to use it to actually just help us see more clearly what's happening in the present moment, as opposed to trying us to institute a change. Yeah.
Is one way to approach this to think that relaxing and concentrating are not intention?
Are not?
Intention with each other, or not antithetical?
No, not at all. And actually in Buddhism they're considered basically synonymous. Often what happens is when people concentrate, they like at work or something, they often bring in a lot of other associated mental factors together with the concentration. And so the concentration is very strained. But pure concentration is actually very relaxing. It's, as I said, in Buddhism they're considered the same. Yes?
In the beginning when you were speaking about clinging to the ball and holding the ball, I wanted to know if it's holding the ball.
What is holding?
Yeah.
Holding doesn't hurt.
Holding
and clinging.
Yeah.
The difference is the difference. I think one of the criteria for noting difference is that clinging hurts. There's suffering involved in clinging. With holding, there's no suffering we're adding in the way we're holding. So the distinction is, are you suffering in what you're doing or not? Are you adding suffering? So if I cling, after a while I feel really tired and exhausted and it hurts in my hand. But if I'm holding it, it doesn't hurt. But maybe what you're asking is how to distinguish them. It's not always so clear. And that's why, especially in our normal consciousness, and that's why developing some stability and calmness in our meditation, learn to see more clearly, we'll start being able to differentiate. As practice gets deeper for us and we start seeing more clearly, we start differentiating between what is holding and what is clinging. And I guess it's an important thing, because sometimes people think that holding is the problem, and we'll let go of things inappropriately, where it actually was fine to hold them. I saw a hand here before.
Well, I sort of answered the question myself, I think, but I'll ask it anyway. Your comment for me was very timely when you said congratulations that your mind was out of control, because I was getting kind of discouraged at not being able to focus up to my standard anyway on my breath, and I was so it was good that you said that for me, but I pictured myself later going home and suffering the same frustration and fearing that I would throw in the towel, and so I'm just wondering how, you know, you said patience is the key. I'm just wondering how one perseveres. Do you recommend, I've heard there's value in coming to group meditation, or what? You know, I just know that, you know, I'm sort of kind of wary of not hanging in there.
So that's a good question, and that gives me an excuse to say some things I was going to say anyway. So thank you for it. How do we support an ongoing practice of mindfulness? First, what I like to recommend is that during these 5 weeks that you're coming here, that if you don't already do it, to start a daily meditation practice where every day you're going to sit at, to begin with this first week, 20 minutes a day. And that's what we sat for together now, is 20 minutes. And then then this is for this week, and then following week, next 2 weeks, add 5 minutes each week until you get to 30 minutes. And then just keep it at 30, or you can increase it, continue to increase it 5 minutes a day if you'd like, but so that within 3 weeks you're doing 30 minutes. At the end of the 5-week course, you can decide to do something else if you want, but folk dancing or something. But or continue if you find it useful. But the point being, during this course, I think you'll find the course much more useful for you if you have that commitment to sit every day. And it can be difficult to find the encouragement sometimes to do it in our, or the time to do it in our busy lives. So to choose a time of the day where you're most likely to do it, where you're kind of committed to doing it. Most people find that the first thing in the morning works best before the various demands of the day begin. But some people find that it works best to do it when they get home from work or in the evening before going to bed. Find what time works for best for you so you can really do it each day. Having one place in your house that is your meditation place, where nothing else happens there, like a little corner of your bedroom maybe, where that corner, that's for meditation. So the associations with meditation are in that place. When you go there, that's what you think about. When you see that place, you think, oh, that's my meditation place, and nothing else happens there. That can be very helpful. Being a little bit attentive and sophisticated about how tricky the mind can be is also helpful. The mind is really tricky. It has no... it has no shame. And like, for example, you can be sitting there in meditating, and then after 10 minutes, it becomes absolutely necessary. This is the absolute time that it's necessary. It has to happen right now. Defrosting the freezer. Something will cause, this has to be now. Cleaning the garage or something. The mind will have all these tricks. So you have to have success. Someone said, it's a blessing to be able to laugh at yourself, because then you'll never cease being humored. So being a little bit wary of the tendency of the mind to trick you, and just kind of see it and let go of it and come back and do it. It's helpful to get some kind of a timing system, so you're not looking at your watch all the time to know when 20 minutes is up. So to have some little, like a kitchen timer or something that's kind of, that makes a nice sound, that's kind of, you know, after 20 minutes goes off. Some people I've heard of get, a tape recorder and a cassette tape, 20 minutes of silence. And the end of that 20 minutes, they ring a bell. And then when they're going to meditate, they just stick their meditation tape in the tape recorder, turn it on, it whirls around, play silence, and then after 20 minutes, you hear a bell. So there's different ways of doing it, but getting some kind of timer to help you will actually, I think, make you less restless in the long run, because you're not constantly looking and wondering, is it over yet? Is it over? Sitting with a group is very helpful. And there's a number of meditation groups around. We have three of them as our community. And you're welcome to come, very welcome to come and join us. We're an informal group. You can come and go as you wish and as it's useful for you. And there are other meditation groups in the area. There's a Zen Center in Mountain View. And you know, it's not so difficult to find groups around. There's one in San Jose. It's connected to us. And there's a lot of support, both visible and invisible, that come with sitting with other people who are meditating. We learn a lot by osmosis, just by their example, seemingly, by how still they sit, they're being inspired by them, and knowing that other people share the value in this kind of activity is very, very helpful when no one else around us is interested in this, you know, and just they're interested in very different values. And they say, "You're doing what? You know, you could be spending the time day trading." So, you know at least here from 7 to 8:30 each day, at least there's a group of people who don't day train during. You know, so they share some values, so that's helpful. So things like that. Yes?
Well, I've been doing this for, I guess, 25 years or so. And I'm not sure that I'm any more skillful about meditating in the sense of having my mind go off less often. You know, some days are better than other days. And what keeps me going is that somehow everything comes together for me so much better if I've done it. And if I meditate every day and if I come here every week, I just grind my teeth less. I mean, all sorts of things. And if I skip it a day because I think I can't work it in, suddenly I think, now I remember why I do this every day.
This is actually very wise. If you try meditation, those of you who are new, for a couple of months or 3 months, and then actually stop doing it for a week, then you might see the benefits you're getting. Sometimes the benefits are really they creep up on you kind of slowly. And sometimes they're not at all visible in the meditation itself. There are some people who meditation practice itself opens to great experiences of calm and ecstasy and great peace. And, you know, it's very pleasant. And there's other people who never have that in their meditation. It's just their mind just busy the whole time. But the latter type, the first type, may or may not see any improvement in their life outside of meditation. Just they have these interesting experiences. But the people who, people often report what you report, that nothing particularly happens to me in my meditation. I seem to still wander just as much as before. But it makes a huge difference in my normal life. Everything seems to go a lot easier. It's a lubricant for daily life. One of the policies I have for myself is if I feel really harried, like I have a lot to do and can't get out of the house quickly enough and answer all the things I have to do, so I'm feeling harried, right? You all know what that's like. And I don't have enough time to do any of it. I'll stop and meditate for 20 minutes. And you think, that's ridiculous. This guy doesn't have enough time to do the things, so why is he, you know, adding that to it all? And what I inevitably find is that after 20 minutes of meditation, I seem to have a lot more time. And I seem to take care of the things just fine. The mind is really tricky in its perceptions and the way we get caught up in things. And the mind, when it's caught up, is not the best judge of itself. You know, the mind that's caught up doesn't really understand what's really going on. So it's really helpful to find some way to step out of the caught up mind a little bit and just sitting a little bit. So you might try that next time, you know, just once. Try my suggestion. If you're really harried and you don't have enough time, nothing's working, just stop and sit for 20 minutes. Last question. Yes?
Well, I just had a comment. When I first started meditating, I took a class. And about halfway through an 8-week class, I realized I'd already been meditating in other parts of my life without knowing it. And the two that popped up, well, three popped up just immediately was being with my niece and nephew. Because with extremely small children, time really is sort of endless. I mean, a day could feel like a week. I don't have to do anything now, you know. And it was very, very natural with the children. Oh, you pick up a stone. Oh, it's a stone. And it's a very meditative state, at least I found it so. And also when I traveled, I realized when I wasn't at home, you know, time loses its meaning almost, especially the farther away you go. And also music for me. And for me, when you play that bell, that has to be the best part of the entire time. I'm but it really does something, that sound.
So the that's a very interesting what you said. And as you begin doing meditation, you might actually start beginning to appreciate even small moments in the day that you had overlooked before, of appreciation, of joy, of calm, of peacefulness. And as you begin appreciating these moments through the day, the appreciation of them strengthens them and makes them more likely to happen. The appreciation of wholesome states makes the wholesome states more likely to happen. So thank you. So what I'd like to do is to end with a short meditation. So again, take a couple of deep breaths and relax. Now the mind has a very strong tendency to want to wander off into thought. One of the ways to help us stay present is to use thoughts to our own advantage. And a very simple way that actually can help your meditation process is to very quietly, very softly label or name the in-breath as in and the out-breath as out. Or some people like the words rising, falling, as a chest or stomach rises and falls. As a very subtle whisper in the mind, so that your thinking part of your mind is actually directing you to feel and sense the inhalation and the exhalation. relaxing into your breathing, feeling the breath, so you can begin to slowly let go of the things that the mind clings to. Please sit every day for 20 minutes, and if you find it useful in your meditation to use this little technique of naming or labeling the in-breath and the out-breath, in-out as you go, it might keep you on track with the breathing much more easily than if you just simply use your bare attention.